I'm so excited to share something with you. I started this podcast because I kept having the same conversations about ADHD and mum life with friends. But then after I started the podcast, the same requests for more information in writing kept popping up in my DMs and Facebook group. That's why I created the ADHD Mums Shop, a place where you can grab the answers to your biggest questions. These guides are straightforward, no fluff, no upsells, no one-to-one, no courses, just the answer to your question that you're asking. If you want a topic added, shoot me an email. Jump in and check it out. Hello and welcome back to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health. Hello and welcome to the next episode of ADHD Mums. Today, I have brought on Beck Sparrow. How are you, Beck?
I'm great, thank you.
So I put a big survey out to the ADHD Mum crew about what subjects everyone wanted to hear most about. And I had a lot of people request around friendships, particularly with girls, and some more content in that area. So of course, I have brought on the first person I thought of, which is Beck Sparrow. So thank you so much for your time, Beck. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here. Friendship is my favorite topic to talk about, so I'm really keen to get into this episode.
Most people have heard of Beck Sparrow, but if you haven't, I'm going to do a really, really brief overview. She's got multiple books that she's written, including Out of the Box, which is her latest book that's only just come out. If anyone wants to read any books, all of the website, you don't need to stress about it. We'll all be in the show notes. And Beck's been in this space for how long, Beck, total?
Probably 20 years, I would say, initially working with high school students, teenagers, yeah, with friendship things.
And Beck has also been co-hosting ABC podcast Parental as Anything this year with her friend Jane Sullivan. And she has been on the Queensland Government Anti-Bullying Task Force. And she was also awarded in 2024 the Queensland Child Protection Week Media and Communications Award for her dedication to educating adults, kids and teens about the dangers which exist online. So we're going to be well known that Beck is an expert. And also, Beck, I wanted to ask you, particularly the new book that you've got, Out of the Box, which is all about neurodiverse people. Are you neurodiverse yourself? Like, where does your interest come from?
That's a good question. So Out of the Box, which I co-wrote with a journalist, Madonna King, is like a one-stop guide to neurodivergence. It is the book that I wish that somebody had given me 5 or 6 years ago when one of my children was diagnosed as autistic and then with ADHD. As for am I neurodivergent, I suspect that I am. I'm probably one of those parents a lot of people can relate to where a child gets a diagnosis and then you start looking at the traits and characteristics and realizing that you tick a lot of those boxes and that it had never occurred to you, particularly as a female, until you start looking at a list and going, oh, but that's me and that's me and that's me. I haven't had a formal diagnosis yet. And I keep saying to myself, why would I do that for me? You know, I can spend that money on the children. But I think that if I went and did that, because I'm quite sure it will say that I am, that it would probably help me make sense of things. But it's the emotion of like going, that would then explain a lot of things of how I've felt my whole life. But yeah, I haven't done it yet, but I would suspect that yes, I am. Yeah.
I don't know where to start with that because I suppose for me, everything that I'm about is about the mother and the way that we put everything on hold ourselves for our children. So that makes complete sense to me. However, I like to talk about putting on your own oxygen mask before putting others on. I suppose that's really one of the reasons that ADHD mums exist because I felt like there was a lot of parenting stuff out there. And it felt like for me that there was a lot of, you know, this is what we should be doing, air quoting. And I was like, but where is the resources for the mum? Like, where is the stuff for her that's not more about what she should be doing for her kids? Where is about actually the help for the mother? So I think it'd be great if you went and got your own diagnosis, or a self-diagnosis is just as good as a formal one. But I actually think it's pretty incredible that you have written so many books if you do have undiagnosed ADHD without medication. That is just insane.
I've written this book with Madonna King on helping parents, especially maybe neurotypical parents, I would guess, who feel overwhelmed that their child is neurodivergent or who don't even have a diagnosis because they can't even afford it or they're on a waiting list and they just think their child is quirky or they've got a gut instinct that there's something and they don't know where to start. So the book is really what we feel is a great starting point. I'm certainly not an expert, but the women that I know who do have ADHD, for example, they're ideas people. And I wonder if the air quote ideas people is code for people whose brains, well, this is me, don't stop with, for me, ideas. Like the moment I wake up in the morning, it is like I have 100 tabs open and it's the overwhelming nature of where my attention is going to go. And I've always seen that not in running a household, which I'm a disaster at, but in business for me, it has been my great strength because somebody comes to me with a business issue and my brain just goes boom with all the ways they could go and the options. And I've always been the person people come to for brainstorming. So it's just interesting, right? I think that I would never have associated that with ADHD, but now I look back on it and I think, okay, these are characteristics, right, of how you can use some of these traits and qualities as a strength for yourself. Does that make sense?
Oh, look, it does. It does. I also think, because I've got your book right here, I got a real quality from it that you had lived experience, which is why I asked the question, because there's something really special about someone who truly gets it. And I'm not sure, I know that you co-wrote it with Madonna, but I thought that there was a really deep understanding component to it that I feel like you can only really get from lived experience.
Certainly for me, that is from my children and also the work I do in schools. And people always say to me, why is your special topic friendship? Like, why is that my Roman Empire? Why do I deep dive on that? And my answer for a long time was, oh, well, I had such a good experience at school because I had chose good friends and that's something that I want for other children. And then I'd realized, no. The reason that I know so much about friendship is because I have found it difficult my entire life. Well, difficult in the sense that I had to research it to unlock it. So for me, I have deep dived on understanding friendships, making friends, navigating conflict, changing friendship groups, asserting boundaries, all of that, because for me, it didn't come naturally. This is what I've realized. I'm such an introverted person, Jane. People think I'm very outgoing. I'm not. I'm writers are hermits, right? I'm very comfortable in my own company. I'm quite sure I come off quite often as aloof. I have a very small group of friends. I'm good one-on-one with people. And I think because it's something that I have had to learn, that I understand that when I'm teaching it to children or teenagers, I break it down into steps. And that is what works really well with neurodivergent children and adults. It's breaking stuff down and explaining to them how to do things. And I think, Jane, that some kids are born with some kind of magic social gene where they find socializing and making friends and making small talk really easy. But for lots of us, me included, it's something I really had to learn. And I think that learning how to make friends and how to make the right friends for you, how to recognize a healthy friendship, how to negotiate tricky moments is a skill in the same way we teach children how to tie their shoes or we teach them how to ride a bike or we teach them math. Learning how to make friends is something the vast majority of children need to learn. And so that's one of the things I'm really passionate about.
Well, I'm going to make a few comments that no one asked. I haven't been asked the question, but I'm can't help myself. I'm very, very passionate about autism assessment and ADHD assessment for women. And it's not necessarily about medication. It's about the knowledge and empowering them and understanding themselves. And I do have a bit of an interesting thing that was coming up when you were talking to me, because I believe, like, for example, I'm a horrific cook, horrific. Even with a recipe, I'm going to struggle, right? And I remember when my husband's mother came and stayed with us, and she's an incredible cook. And I said to him, I just want her to show me how to cook a few things while she's here. Now, she's a natural cook. Everything she touches tastes good. And she doesn't know why. She doesn't know how it happens. It just happens. She gets into the flow and she starts cooking. And when I ask her how she does it, she can't explain it. Mm. That would be my take, is a neurotypical person's way of making friends. If I ask a neurotypical person, how did you make friends? They often don't know. That's my personal opinion. Good cooks don't know. So when you were talking, I was like, for someone who's researched it, broken it down into little steps and learnt it and teaching others, that is a very neurodiverse way of looking at the world. And that's a real talent, because I don't think a neurotypical person would even be able to think to do that. I wrote someone down a spreadsheet the other day, and it was an autistic girl who was starting to date. And I actually wrote her a spreadsheet of, if they text you, when should you reply? And I had to break it down. Is there a question? Is there not a question? Did they say, take care? Break it down into when she would reply and when she wouldn't, because she couldn't figure out what was what. But I don't think a neurotypical approach there, they wouldn't be able to figure out the part she doesn't know.
Oh, I 100% agree with you, because I think so often we say to people, it's instinctive. Just follow your heart. But what does that mean?
Well, you know what? If I follow my heart, I will fuck it all up. That's not a good idea. Don't follow your fucking instincts. It's not good.
No. My God, the analogy with the cooking is so accurate. And I think that for me, I am such an introverted person as a writer. I'm very happy pottering around by myself, that I am at risk of, during my life, of someone who could end up being lonely. It's not instinctive for me always to reach out to people, because I'm so comfortable with my own company. So I've had to teach myself skills and explain things to myself. And I was saying to somebody this morning in conversation that with all of our kids, you can cope with bombing out at school. You can cope with having a bad boss or having a teacher that you don't like. But what is the real killer, I think, is loneliness. And when you feel like there is nobody who gets you, that there is nobody who is happy that you turned up at school that day, who's glad to see you, I think that is what can destroy not just adults, but our children. And so I'm so passionate about helping our children learn the skills, not masking, learning the skills of putting themselves out there a bit and how to find the right people for them, as well as encouraging everybody, neurotypical people, to be inclusive and to have the attitude, there's always room for one more. I want children, even if you have just one great friend, I want that for everybody, because I think loneliness is one of the worst things that we can deal with.
Oh, absolutely. Often our autistic people, particularly women, have got reduced social need. So they do love to connect, but the quantity is a lot less. So going for one coffee a week with your friends may be enough for somebody. However, if you told someone else, that might be one of 10 things that they do that week, which fills up their social cup. But for some autistic women who are married, that relationship with that one other person inside their home may be actually all they can do socially, is they go to the pickup to pick up their children, and they have a partner, male or female, at home, or a family member they're living with, and that may be enough for them socially. So friendship-wise, we also need to be aware of that people have got different needs, don't they? They don't need as much as some other people.
That's it. And I think sometimes there's parents, perhaps especially neurotypical parents, who are panicking that their children aren't more social, when actually their children are getting the amount of socializing that they actually desire. So with one of my kids, they actually take the school holidays as a time where they don't necessarily want to be seeing their school friends, because for them it's a bit of a timeout and they like pottering around at home, and maybe they'll see their friends from school once or twice, but not, you know, I see other kids, it's every day they have to be doing something. So I think the better we can understand neurodiversity and understand our children, we're not putting expectations on them of how we think they should be, how many friends we think they should have, how many social things we think they should be invited to. If it's not a problem for your child, it's probably not a problem. If they're not in stress going, I wish I was invited to more things and I want to be going to more parties or I want to be on more play dates. If they're not stressing about it, then we need to not be stressing about it. Unless you're concerned that they are flying so far under the radar and seeing nobody and have no connections, that would be a red flag to me of like, okay, they've got nothing. Then I'd be wanting to investigate that. But if you could see they've got something and it might not be as much as other kids, that's okay. It's up to them. Does that, am I making sense to you, Jane?
Oh, no, completely. I think Tony Atwood said to me, is your child lonely or are they alone? Because if they're alone and they're happy, nothing to do here. Done.
Yeah, there's right. A huge, but you could be in a huge group of people and feel very alone because they don't get you and they don't see you and you have to pretend to be something that you're not. That's a lonely feeling, right? So it's not about are they around people, is are they getting the amount of social connection that they desire?
Oh, absolutely. One of the largest ones that I see on the podcast from a lot of the women who are in the groups or they write in is that they will talk about setting boundaries, particularly with their children. One of the issues that we have is because a lot of us mums don't always know how to do this ourselves. So we've got blind leading the blind and we're faced with these questions, but we actually don't even know the answer ourselves for ourselves, let alone to then help our children. I was wondering what strategies would be able to help with defining and communicating boundaries.
Okay, so this is something that I go into schools and talk about a lot. I love this topic and I wish this is something that I learned as a kid actually. So when we talk about personal boundaries, that is just a fancy way of saying what you are okay with, right? So that's the first thing that I would say to kids is it's what you're okay with. And boundaries cover everything. They cover conversations, they can cover privacy, they can cover activities, time, you know, all of. So you might have a boundary that is, I don't do roller coasters, or I don't do sleepovers, or I don't do scary movies. Or, you know, with older teenagers, I'm saying, you're allowed to say, I don't respond to text messages at 1 o'clock in the morning. You know, you're allowed to say that. It could be, I'm not okay with you looking through my phone. You know, for siblings, I'm not okay with you going into my room without knocking. The reason we want to be teaching this idea of how to communicate a boundary and the language is you want to keep it short and to the point, which is I'm not okay with or I don't do, right? I don't do. Because when you phrase it like that, it's not up for negotiation. The moment you say, oh, you know, I'd love to do 5 a.m. yoga, but it's just I struggle to get up. The moment you phrase things like that, people, they feel like they have to convince you. Oh, it's okay. I'll ring you. I'll set an alarm. I'll come around and pick you up. You'll love it. The moment you say, however, I don't do 5 a.m. yoga, I don't do fun runs, I don't do whatever, it's a statement. So that takes practice, right? I teach kids at school to say, I don't do drama cyclones, right? So you work out what your personal boundaries are. You practice saying them. You realize that as you get older, your boundaries can change. You might not do sleepovers when you're 8 or 11. You might be cool doing them when you're 16. And the other thing that I would say is expect the fact that when you communicate a boundary, it's not going to be all unicorns and rainbows and cupcakes. People don't go, oh, brilliant. I'm so glad you told me that you don't want to watch that movie that we all want to watch. I think sometimes you have to realize that sometimes when we don't do what other people want us to do, it's going to annoy them. That's okay. So you can be firm but kind, and you don't have to ever shame other people for their choices. So your friends might be saying, we're all going to get Meat Lover's pizza for lunch. And you don't want to be going, how very dare you? I'm vegan and that's offensive to me. You could say, you know what, guys, you get that. I'm going to get this and I'll meet you over at the tables. Or I don't do scary movies. If you guys want to watch that, that's fine. I'll go and listen to a podcast or I'll read a book or I'll get mum to pick me up early and I'll see you later. The big thing is with a boundary, Jane, is there has to be a consequence, which means if you say, I don't do scary movies, and they're like, well, too bad, we're all doing it, If you then go, oh, okay, you will end up resenting them, because when we don't have boundaries in relationships, we end up feeling walked over. We're not inserting any part of ourselves into a relationship. And so I think that eats away at us, that we're not sticking up for ourselves and our values or our desires, and we're kind of going along with whatever the group wants. And so I think practicing communicating a boundary, and as I say to teenagers, I want you to learn this when you're a kid, because when you get a job, I want you to be able to say as a teenager, I don't do unpaid overtime. When you're dating, I want you to be able to say, I'm not okay with you telling me what I can wear. I'm not okay with you looking through my phone at my messages. So if we could learn this now in friendships, of being able to communicate what we're comfortable with, I think that is going to stand us in very good stead for the rest of our lives.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I really am very strong on my belief that I think, as well as, you know, seeking help for our child if they are neurodiverse, so, you know, taking them for an assessment if that's needed. Sometimes parents miss the step, would we actually speak to the child about the diagnosis? Sometimes that step is actually missed. And it's usually only of good intentions, because it's such a difficult conversation and sometimes people avoid it. I did that with my oldest for quite a while. I kept thinking, later on I'll tell her. And then when I did an episode on talking to your child about being diagnosed, that I then went, oh, actually, this is a really important step that I haven't done yet. But I suppose by letting them know and talking to them about being diagnosed, it also helps them be able to say no a little bit more effectively, which is what you're talking about. So about, okay, I know that I don't like loud noises, so I'm not going to be able to go to that concert. And being able to say no confidently at a young age, right from the beginning, and understanding what is good for you and what isn't, I think that would be easier if you were probably practicing that from an earlier age. Would that be right?
Oh, I think so. And I look back now and I sort of think, there is no normal. I thought there was something wrong with me as a teenager, and even in my 20s when I just never really liked going to parties where there were a lot of people and there was a lot of loud music. And so you think there's something wrong with you. And I sort of think, no, there's no normal. You can just be you. And you're allowed to not like going to parties, or you're allowed to not like going to concerts, or you're allowed to whatever it is. You don't have to like sleepovers, you know? And I think that is a comfort. When you can learn that, and it is part of respecting yourself and going, that's okay. I'm okay. I'm allowed to be different. What I'm comfortable with, Jane, is going to be different to what you're comfortable with. And that's okay. That's okay. We don't want to have such big boundaries and walls up that we never let anyone in. So at times you do want to have flexibility. At times you will think, oh no, that's something I'm willing to negotiate on. But for things that are really important to you, the more that you can advocate for yourself, the better.
Yeah, and being assertive is a real skill, I think, that needs to be practiced. And we're talking about doing those smaller steps from a younger age. So then when you do have a really important thing to stand up for yourself, it's not the first time you've ever done it before, because that would be a really hard thing to do. So let's say our child has found a friend. Sometimes I've noticed that neurodivergent children, I suppose, not having that connection, feeling really lost. And so when they get a friendship opportunity, I feel like they can jump at it without thinking about whether it's actually healthy or not. What signs do we need to look for with our children that the friendship is actually healthy and goes both ways?
Look, I've got a few tips here. The first thing I would say, encourage people, and you might be able to do this in a link in your show notes, is social researcher Dr. Brené Brown has a list that she calls the anatomy of trust, which is amazing. And she uses the acronym BRAVING. And she lists the qualities, which I'll go through, of what she says creates trust in a relationship. And it works beautifully for friendship. So BRAVING is B, boundaries. Do they respect my boundaries when I say I'm not okay with whatever, right? R, reliability. Do they do what they say they're going to do? So when my friend says, yeah, I'll meet you at lunchtime and we'll play handball, do they show up? Right? It's those kind of things. A, I think, is accountability, which is, do they own their impact? So when they screw up, which we all do, do they apologize and own that behavior? V is vault. When you share personal things with them, do they keep it to themselves or are they spreading it as gossip? I is integrity. Do they behave the same way around the teachers as they do around you? We've all seen the kids who are angels in front of the teachers. The moment the teachers or adults' backs are turned, they're like a different person. N is non-judgmental. Can you be yourself around them? You're quirky or uncool or whatever it is. Can you love what you love in front of your friend? And G is probably my favorite, which is generous lens, which is, do they look at you through a generous lens and give you the benefit of the doubt? So I think those are things that we can keep in mind when we're talking about friendship. The other thing that I would say is, are you seeing a pattern? If you are seeing a pattern of negative behavior where they have numerous times excluded you, betrayed you, or embarrassed you, or hurt your feelings, that would be a red flag. Everybody screws up in friendship, particularly our kids because they're learning. But a one-off thing is different to something that is happening over and over. So I would say look for patterns in friendship. And probably the last one I would say is, do you like who you are when you're with them? You know, do you think they're bringing out your best self? And do you like who you are? And do you feel safe when you're with them? You know, they are all big things that I think can help us work out if we're in a good friendship. Because Jane, I can spend an hour saying to you, here's tips on making friends, do this and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But unless you have a good friendship radar and you actually know what a good friendship looks like, you don't want to just make any old friends. You want to make friends who are good for you, right? Who are going to bring out your best self, who are going to like you for who you are. That's why understanding what a good friendship looks like is so critical. So I always say to parents, we want to look at helping our children have a really good friendship radar.
So they have a friend, and let's say it's a healthy relationship, and they get into conflict because that is what's going to happen in any friendship. You know, what are some ways that we can approach conflict or some techniques that we can kind of talk to our kids about? Because possibly we don't really know how to do that yet either.
Absolutely. Okay. So tips for conflict. One of the things I say to kids and to parents is try to be someone who's not easily offended. Now, that doesn't mean don't ever be offended, but sometimes I think, and this is maybe with some people, not with everyone, we can go through the world looking to see other people hurting our feelings. And if you are going to be constantly on the lookout, oh, that person looked at me a funny way, that person didn't save me a seat, whatever, school is going to be exhausting because you're going to have many moments every day. So part of it is being a bit thicker skin sometimes and realizing a lot of kids every day are going to turn up in a bad mood, right? I often say people can be jerks at school. Not talking about bullying. I'm talking about when people turn up to school or work just in a bad mood. It's got nothing to do with you, but sometimes they can be a bit snarky. That's when you've got to learn at school how to glide around those people. That's what I taught my kids. When you see someone's in a bit of a bad mood and they're being a bit like, oh, what's wrong with your hair today? Or, oh, that drawing you just did is ridiculous. You want to learn how to glide, like don't look offended, just glide around those people and give them space and move away from them, I think. The other thing I'd say with conflict when it happens, conflict is completely normal in friendships. Drama is a choice. So what we want to do is, okay, somebody's hurt your feelings. You've had a misunderstanding with a friend. What I try and say to kids is don't then go to your friend and start going, do you know what this person just did to me? Because you're starting a drama cyclone, right? What I say to them is someone's upset you at school. Wait until you get home so you can speak to an adult that you love or a cousin or an older sibling and vent. This happened and have your big vent there, right? And calm down about it. Because what I see all the time is kids get on each other's nerves and they go to the other friends at school and it starts a drama cyclone. Drama cyclones are exhausting. They are exhausting at school. And I don't want our children turning up at school at 9 a.m. Oh, and they've got a thing happening with that person. Oh, and they're having a beef with that person over there. School is a long game, right? So what we want to realize is When someone upsets you at school, you have two choices. Either you let it go. If it's minor, you might go, you know what, that person's in a bad mood, I'm going to ignore it. Or you speak to them about it. You don't go to your group of friends and go, do you know what this person did to me at the bag racks today? Because that's starting a cyclone. If it's really upset you, you take them aside by themselves, not in front of the class, because this is not Real Housewives, right? We take them aside by themselves and we say, listen, I really like you, but earlier today when you said this really hurt my feelings. Can we talk about it? But conflict is going to happen at school. Our kids are learning about friendship as they go. It's hard. It's hard for adults, let alone kids with less life experience. They're going to make mistakes, but a really big part of healthy friendships is an ability to apologize. In fact, the strongest friendships are the friendships where there is a safety and an understanding that you can screw up and you can apologize. Now, I don't mean screw up the same way over and over, because then you'd go, that's a pattern, but we're all going to make mistakes in friendships.
And I suppose as parents, we have the opportunity to model that, don't we? Where we can acknowledge and say, hey, I made a mistake then, I'm sorry, you know, and then modeling how that looks to then restore the relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. I think modeling is huge in all of this stuff, in what friendships look like, showing up for our friends, apologizing, not gossiping about our friends in front of our kids, all of that stuff. We can teach our kids about friendship until the cows come home. They are watching what we do, you know. So I think us showing in real time what friendship looks like is really important.
What about comparison and jealousy? You know, particularly for kids that feel left out or not connected, maybe they feel jealous, compare themselves to their friends or their siblings, particularly in areas of friendship if they're struggling. How do we kind of work through those feelings with our kids?
That is such a good question. And I see that happen in my own household where I've got three kids and one child might be much more of a social butterfly. Drop them off at school, kids rush over to say hello. They get lots of invitations. And another child, that's not happening. And I think even in that, there's that envy of why isn't that happening for me? And I know parents would be dealing with this in all different forms, or just seeing a classmate who excels at something that your child wishes that they could excel at. And I think that's going to happen all through our lives. I think one of the best things that we can do as parents is realize we don't have to fix everything. That simply listening and being compassionate and empathetic is very powerful. So when our child says, oh, why isn't that happening for me? And I'm feeling this, and sitting with them and just going, yeah, it's really tough. And just listening to them can make an enormous difference to our children feeling better. When we rush in, and I know I've made this mistake in the past, oh, well, don't worry, I'll go and get you, blah, 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 or I'll fix this. I don't want your feelings to be hurt, because we're so uncomfortable with our kids being uncomfortable. So it is very powerful to sit with our children and listen and acknowledge that we're hearing them. And I think the other thing is, the more we can help our children find that thing in their life that lights them up, then they feel like they have got something for themselves. It's especially hard with neurodivergent children because they can be left out of things. They can find some things a real struggle that other kids find easy. And having these moments of your child saying, you know, why am I the one who's not invited? Or why am I not included in this? It makes you want to cry as a parent. But I think us rushing to fix things all the time isn't always the answer. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it is. And we're like, come on, let's go and get a milkshake, you know, whatever, you know. But sometimes it's just as powerful for us to sit with them and listen and hear them and remind them how loved they are in your house. And the more as well that we can help them find a friend or a group of friends outside of the school bubble, I think is very helpful as well, of having an identity and a sense of belonging away from school. Because I think too often we just focus on the school bubble. And I think it's really powerful to have a great friend or connections and a sense of belonging outside of school that can kind of ease sometimes. But jealousy and envy is part of life. We are all going to feel it at different times, and it's very uncomfortable. And I think just not trying to sweep it under the carpet and say to kids, oh, don't be ridiculous. Well, you're good at maths or you're good at this. We want to hear them when they're saying, I'm really upset because, acknowledging it and listening and going, yeah, I get that. That sounds really hard. Makes them feel heard.
And I suppose, you know, the majority of people on this podcast are women, and most of us, I think, would have had that feeling when you say, I'm really upset about this. And they go, oh, but you're so good at this. Oh, but don't worry about that. You know, and then not allowing you to really experience that or problem solving it for you. How does that feel for us as adults? Pretty shitty. So again, why would you jump in and just band-aid it without allowing them time to talk and validating their feelings? I completely agree with that.
Because then you're thinking in your head, you don't get it.
Totally. You're right. If it's like, I am so upset because someone at pickup said this to me about my child, let's say, right? Or looked at me or did something. And then, yeah, your friend or partner or someone says to you, but you've got heaps of other friends, you don't need them. Like, but that's not relevant to that experience in that moment.
Exactly. Exactly. It's really powerful. It's so simple, but it's really powerful to listen and acknowledge.
And that may be all you need.
All you need. So we need to do it with each other and we need to do it with our children.
Yes. When I have a conversation with my husband now, I give him a label. I say to him, listening, listening. And then other times I say problem solving. And he has to know which one.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't know.
Perfect.
Yes. Yes. So I said to him the other day when my daughter was really upset about something, he's just started problem solving. Listening, listening. And he's like, oh, we're listening. We're listening. So we're always listening. You know, some partners are just so good with guidance. And he's one of those people. It's like he just needs a bit of guidance. And he's like, I'm good to go. But don't expect him to guess.
Yeah.
He's not good with the guessing. Okay. So one thing that we see on this podcast a lot, and, you know, oh, well, you would see it constantly in what you do, but in the autistic experience, particularly with the way that women and females and daughters are getting identified now, there's a lot of women who are reflecting back on their friendships, their social, and there can be, not always, a really autistic experience around, I'm looking for one friend, I find one friend is my friend. Now, that friend cannot go anywhere else. And there's two issues that happens is, one, you've got the child who only has one friend, and they are so emotionally invested in that one friend that anything that goes wrong with that one friend completely derails them. Or you're the parent of the friend who then you feel that your child is being controlled, air quoted, or, you know, not allowed to have other friends. And then often you hear of the parent that goes, can my child be separated from the other child for the next year? And the child that is trying to control, or, you know, I don't want to use the word control, but you know what I'm saying. They are then left in the dark and they're like, I'm no longer in a class with my friend. How has this happened? I watch it constantly. And I was wondering what your take on that would be from Bo's perspective, I suppose.
Oh, look, I get it because I think I was the person growing up who kind of, I don't think I was ever controlling, but definitely kind of tended to lock on to one friend. And I'd be like, but this is all I need.
Look, that was me too. And my best friend that I controlled in primary school is still my friend. And it was a healthy friendship. Well, at times I feel quite bad because I think I was probably mean at times when things didn't go my way. She didn't do what I wanted her to do. I was mean. And it was only been recently when I figured out I was autistic that I could understand it, because I used to actually think about this a lot, thinking, why was I mean to her some days? Was I a bully? And I never felt that I was a bully. But yet some of the things that I did to her, my best friend, was mean. But I'll be angry with her when she didn't do what I wanted.
And I think there's just, look, it's a big learning curve. Friendships is hard. We're learning this as kids. We're learning all of this, right? And I think
absolutely. And I remember my mum sitting down with me crying. She was devastated. Why are you acting like this? And I didn't know.
Well, I get it. So what I would say to parents is, to explain to their kids, is it's a very vulnerable situation to put yourself in at school where you've got one friend, right? Because that one friend then is away with COVID or they're at gymnastics camp. You have to walk into that school. Who are you going to sit with, right? So I talk to kids about, sure, have your close friends. And it's not a numbers game. It's quality. So you maybe only have one or two or three close friends at school. That's fine. But be friendly. Try to be friendly to lots of people so that when you get put into a class without your best friend, you've been friendly to people that you can at least go, oh yeah, can I sit here? Or they'll chat to you. If you've ignored everybody else in your class or your grade and focus solely on one person, that's a very vulnerable situation to put yourself in. So there's that. The other aspect is I want you to have friends outside of school or more than one friend at school because of peer pressure. Now, peer pressure can be a positive thing. You can have friends around you who the peer pressure is, oh, we all work really hard on our assignments or we all do community service. That's positive peer pressure. But negative peer pressure is, of course, the opposite, which is, oh, we're all going to vape or we're all going to wag school today. Now, if you've only got one friend or one group of friends at school and no other friends in your life, and they are doing something negative, you are far more likely to buckle and go along with them because they're all you've got, right? The risk of losing them is too high for children so often. Like, well, I don't really want to do this, but if I don't, that's my one friendship group. So I think when you know, okay, I've actually got these other people outside of school, or I've got this, I'm also friends with the kids in band, I'm friends with the kids in robotics or chess club, you feel more confident to say to another group, I don't want to do that. That sounds like a bad idea. Knowing, well, I've actually got this other group I can go to.
Okay, so what if you are the parent of the child that is attempting to make some other friends, but they're being physically, emotionally cut off making friends elsewhere? Because usually what I see is that that parent then asks for that child to be separated from their friend the next year at school, which I think is probably a lose-lose really overall.
Yeah, and this might come down to boundaries, Jane. This might come down to teaching your child to say to their friend, I really like you, but I also want to go and play handball with this group over here today. Now, you can come, but I really want to play handball. Or they're playing hide and seek, or they're playing chess, and I want to go over there. So that's a boundary of I like playing with you, but if you're going to have a meltdown because I want to sit with other people, I need to have a time out from you today. So this could be a boundaries conversation. You'd like to think maybe the parents could work together, but I've also seen situations where, you know, it can be disastrous if one parent rings another parent and says,
yeah.
You could try and work with the teachers and say, look, we do want to broaden my child's friendships. We don't want them to walk away from this friend, but we do want to broaden it. And sometimes summer teachers are amazing at then kind of doing a bit of matchmaking at school and go, okay, well, I'm also going to introduce this other child to these people who I think they'll like, and kind of working that way. So often, if we work with the school and with teachers, it can be brilliant. So having a great relationship with parents and teachers working together can be brilliant for our children.
Oh, I completely agree. I had a situation like that this year where my child was the one who was kind of being controlled, which is kind of funny because I was the other one when I was at school. So I was so triggered by the whole thing. But it was interesting. I ended up talking to the teachers because I said to the teachers, what outlier have you got? Like, have you got another child that's an outlier that's always on the outside? Who do you think might be a good friend for my child? And actually that was really good because that helped me identify. I'm not trying to force her into a already established group or clique, but they know her. They know her brain and how she works. What other children are similar? And interesting, the teachers are quite open. Well, I found them to be quite open with me.
There's so often is another child. Some friendship groups, when they're steady, they kind of lock their gates because they're like, they've got a steady friendship group and they're like, we don't want anyone else coming in because we're finally stable. But there's often other kids floating around that actually are perfect to sort of go, oh, okay, well, this could be a good situation coming over here. So I think working with teachers can be brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I heard someone the other day, they were talking about how a group of friends were leaving these other children out. And so the parents actually talked to each other, the ones who were being left out. And then there was three of them. They just formed their own friendship. Fixed.
Yeah,
I was like, it's so simple. They just contacted each other. It's like, our children are crying every day because they're constantly left out by these other three girls. But there were three girls. So then they just made friends, which apparently they'd never thought of before. These girls are young. They're like eight.
Yes.
Yeah. And then their parents helped them make a friendship, and then there was no issue.
There we go. So there's often solutions. Working with the school, with the teachers, they know they're there all the time. They know who's who in the zoo. You can then find new friendship situations. So, yeah, that's a perfect.
Yeah, the teacher was really happy because she was getting all these phone calls about these kids being left out. And then, you know, what do you know? They created a friendship group out of them.
Perfect.
Beck, thank you so much for your time. Not even gotten through really a lot of my questions, to be honest. I just was reflecting about how much more that I'd really love to ask you. I was wondering, would you be willing to come back if we did a write in your questions from everybody? We could do scenarios back to you.
Oh, Jane, I would love it. I want your listeners to send in their friendship questions and we'll do a Q&A and I'll answer them in the episode. Be brilliant.
If there's anything that you would like to ask Beck, send me an email or look her up yourself, buy her books. And thank you so much for your time, Beck.
Thank you, Jane. I can't wait to chat to you again.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.
Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD Mums shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au. This tool is specifically designed to help you access practitioners who truly understand masking and camouflaging, ensuring that you get value for your money after the long wait times and investment involved in assessments. So go over to the website, grab a resource, and support your journey.